Three little words frame the economic debate we are having right now. Trickle, down, and economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 7th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And it really is, by the way. I know I say that, but it really is. We begin today with two news updates, a quick review of coverage so far, and then a turn to economic theory from days gone by. The topic at hand, of course, is the GOP's tax bill. The updates go like this. The House version is still being amended. Final text expected Thursday. Keyword there, expected. Also on Thursday, we will see the Senate version. So far, we have covered this thing six ways from Sunday. Credits, deductions, exemptions, you name it. But being in the home stretch here brings up some basic economic questions. Most specifically, will these tax cuts grow the economy in a way that will benefit everybody? Seemingly simple idea, very different answers on either side of the economic aisle. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Here's an ad out today that pretty much sums up the tax cuts help us all argument. It's put out by the Business Roundtable.
Tax reform, in our opinion, can help the economy grow. If the economy grows faster, companies like ours invest more. We hire more. Wages go up.
The guy talking owns a business that makes engine parts. And yeah, Gordon Gray, director of fiscal policy at the American Action Forum, says that's basically how it works. Lower corporate taxes do spur investment.
When a company is looking to build a factory or make a new investment, it looks at its, what will the return to that investment be? Is it worth it? Lowering the corporate rate essentially makes that decision easier, and so it encourages that investment.
That investment, Gray says, will increase productivity, which will increase wages. Sort of an economic chain reaction. Simple enough, or is it? Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
I'm not saying there might not be some effects in terms of investment or productivity or wages, but those effects have been found to be very small, and that's in a well-designed tax plan. This one is not particularly well-designed.
He points to the impact of previous tax cuts and increases.
Bill Clinton raised taxes and growth was solid. Ronald Reagan cut taxes and growth was pretty good. And by the way, then Ronald Reagan raised taxes 11 times and again, growth was decent during his term. The fact is that these tweaks to the tax code are just not the determinants of economic growth.
He says the economic chain reaction sounds good in theory, but in practice, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There is some new data out about housing that's worth a minute or two here. The Census Bureau says that in the third quarter, homeownership in this country ticked up to 63.9%, the highest level since 2014. Kind of runs contrary, doesn't it, to the conventional wisdom of not enough houses on the market and prices that are too high. Marketplace's Rima Crace gives us the context.
Earlier this year, Carolyn Bischoff's husband lined their basement with hundreds of books. It's her favorite part of her new house.
Like, you would not be surprised to find out we're both librarians, but they're all his books.
The couple bought the small house in Minneapolis for $200,000, thanks to some help from their parents in the form of a wedding gift.
So the financial part of it kind of lined up for us.
Most of this gain in home ownership is in the Midwest. The Midwest is the affordable region.
Susan Wachter is a real estate professor at Wharton. She says the home ownership rate has been ticking up for months now. Why? Rents have been rising. There's a lot of pent-up demand among first-time buyers.
And it's an increase in jobs. That's key here, that the job market has been improving.
Things are headed in the right direction, but the new census numbers don't carry a lot of weight, says Richard Green of USC's Less School of Real Estate.
The homeownership rate, based on history, should be a little higher than it is right now. And the main reason for that is the country is getting older.
And typically age leads to marriage, leads to home buying. Green says the rate should be in the neighborhood of 65%. We're at 63.9. So we're close, right?
That's like 1.5 million people. Actually, it's 1.5 million households, so it's like 4 million people.
And many of those are millennials who grew up during the financial crisis and who still haven't gotten over what they saw their parents go through. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, look, flat, it's the new down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hey. As the theoretical deadline for Britain leaving the European Union approaches, March of 2019, again in theory, because, hey, everything is negotiable, the looming economic consequences are concentrating minds over there. The Bank of England predicts 75,000 jobs could be lost just in financial services. Business groups warn jobs and investment are going to suffer unless there's some kind of transition deal worked out by Christmas that would delay and, in theory, there's that word again, smooth the exit. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now on Brexit second guesses.
Stop Brexit! It's not a done deal!
On the street outside Parliament, waving two big European flags and wearing another one on his hat, protester Stephen Bray leaves no room for doubt about where he stands on Brexit.
Stop Brexit!
He's not the only one who thinks that Britain's decision to leave the EU could be reversed. In Brussels, Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, apparently does too.
It is in fact up to London how this will end. With a good deal, no deal, or no Brexit.
The talks over an exit deal have been going badly. Opposition lawmaker Tom Brake says,
"We're going to be poorer and less influential. This is a catastrophe for the UK, and chaos reigns."
The talks are stalled over how much Britain should pay to get out of the bloc. The cabinet's divided, and as departure date draws nearer, more dire predictions emerge of the economic hit to the UK. If there's no deal to delay and smooth the exit, and no trade deal at the end of it, members of Tom Brake's party, the pro-European Liberal Democrats, are calling for a second referendum.
What we want to try and secure is a vote on the facts of what leaving the European Union means, and hopefully manage to convince people that, with hindsight, we're better off staying in the European Union.
Britain would be better off staying in the EU, say many of the companies that trade with the bloc. For some exporters to the continent, Brexit is a major headache. Take the British subsidiary of the Japanese pharma company Eisai. It cannot sell any of its drugs in the EU unless they've been tested in a member country, which, as things stand, Britain will cease to be within 17 months. Senior executive David Jefferies.
We have to look to move that part of the testing operation, not the manufacturing, but the testing, to an EU member state and put things in place.
And that's diverting cash away from the company's real business.
We're talking many millions of pounds to do this, money which could have been spent for developing new medicines and bringing new cures to patients.
Is Britain having second thoughts about Brexit? And if it fails to secure a satisfactory exit deal, could Brexit be stopped?
I think it's possible but unlikely that Brexit will not happen.
John Springford of the Pro-Europe Centre for European Reform.
To reverse Brexit and not have a huge backlash, there would have to be quite a significant shift in public opinion.
But he says, in spite of the complaints from business and in spite of the stalled exit talks, public opinion isn't really shifting very much.
We've had lots and lots of opinion polls, and it always spits out a similar result, about 50-50.
When Donald Tusk once mused about Britain calling off Brexit, he quoted John Lennon.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Yes, said Tusk, he could imagine Britain staying in the EU.
You may say I am a dreamer, but I am not the only one. Thank you.
No Brexit? In your dreams, say the Brexiteers, and they for now are still calling the tune. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Walt Disney Company and the Los Angeles Times have come to an agreement of sorts to end what was becoming an embarrassing standoff for Disney. The company had blacklisted LA Times reviewers from reviewing its upcoming feature films, upset over an investigative series the paper had run a couple of months ago. But as critics from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and elsewhere announced they would boycott Disney movies in solidarity with the LA Times, Disney blinked. Make no mistake, though, Disney is by far the most powerful movie studio in Hollywood right now, and it is leveraging that power to maximize profits from the new Star Wars movie that opens just before Christmas. Eric Schwartzel wrote about that in the Wall Street Journal. Eric, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What are the terms here that Disney is imposing on all these theaters?
They are unprecedented in their scope. They are going to receive 65% of all ticket sales on this next Star Wars movie. They also can require theaters to hold the theater for 4 weeks. So that means this new Star Wars movie will show in the biggest auditorium at any theater for a minimum of a month.
Even if on, you know, day 28-ish, everybody who's going to see it has seen it and they're playing to an empty house.
Right. And that's a real problem if you only have one auditorium in your whole theater. And so I spoke with some smaller theater owners, like this one guy who runs a theater in Elkader, Iowa, which has a population of about 1,200 people.
Wow.
And he's not showing the new Star Wars movie, which might sound like a bad business move on his part. But he says after 2 weeks, he literally runs out of people to show it to.
Are they doing this, Disney, simply because they can?
Yes, they have unprecedented market power right now. One film buyer I spoke to said they are the most powerful studio maybe since MGM in the 1930s. They have an unbelievable market share. Their movies are guaranteed hits, and they know what they have. And so they can, you know, ask theaters to adhere to these terms, and very few are going to say no.
And they're doing that with fewer movies on the market than most other major studios, right?
Right. They released 13 movies in 2016 and yet had a 26% market share of the total box office. And I think the next highest market share was Warner Brothers, and they had released, I think, more than 20 films that year.
Right, with a smaller market share.
Right.
A word here about the relationship between theaters and studios, and I should have known this, it should have occurred to me, but it dawned on me when I was reading this article. There's actually contractual relationships, right? I mean, the studios sign a contract with Disney that says X, Y, Z, and if you don't do this, then we're going to take, you know, your firstborn child.
Right, right. Or about 5%, which for some theaters after this year is the equivalent of a firstborn child.
Right.
They're not doing so well.
Well, I was just, right. That's the other part of this, is that the box office sales are down, generally speaking, which gives Disney more oomph.
Exactly. And there's been this mantra among theater owners, you know, whenever they have to talk to investors on these conference calls for the past couple quarters, it's just been bad news after bad news. But this mantra that they've been giving is wait until December, wait until December, wait until December. And they just keep saying Star Wars and some other big releases in the fourth quarter will compensate for the losses that they've seen. So you're coming into these negotiations with Disney, the most powerful studio in Hollywood history, with their biggest movie, and theater owners really hurting. You can see how lopsided the leverage has become.
Have you bought tickets yet?
I have not. No.
You probably get a freebie, right?
There's no easy way to say this. I usually go to the premiere. But although I haven't gotten invited to this one yet. I don't know how it will go after this story. But
Eric Schwarzel, he covers the film industry for the Wall Street Journal. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Everybody, I keep hearing from everybody, where's Wall Street's Harvey Weinstein?
I mean, you hope he's not there, but you'd want to know if he is, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 8 points today, less than a 0.1%, closed at 23,557. NASDAQ off 18.2%, 67.67. The S&P 500 basically flat, ended things at 25.90. Results rattled some travel stocks. TripAdvisor Journey down 23.2% today. Third quarter earnings for the online travel site missed expectations. Priceline discounted 13.5% today as its forecast for the current quarter disappointed analysts, which is, of course, mostly what matters. Rival travel site Expedia rushed down 2.7% today. Bond prices up just a hair. Yield on the 10-year Tino pretty much stuck at 2.31%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a fairly standard, if unevenly applied across this economy, list of benefits that people get from their employers. A 401k most of the time. Health insurance, again, most of the time. Paid sick leave if you're lucky. How about, though, a little help paying off your student loans? Debt repayment assistance, as it's known, is an increasingly popular perk in this tight labor market. And also, not for nothing, it's a business opportunity as well. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Maybe you've seen the ads. A somber voice ticks off the debts a young woman piled up as she struggled through college.
Why did she borrow $42,000 for tuition? Why did she borrow $19,400 for room and board?
She did it to work for you, the announcer tells potential employers.
And now you can do something for her.
That something is help paying off her debts. The company behind the ads is called Gratify with a D. It provides and manages an online portal that allows employers to make direct payments on their workers' student loans.
So we just opened up a new floor.
At the company's headquarters in downtown Boston, CEO Tim DeMello shows off a recent expansion.
You know, I started the company a couple of years ago. There was just three of us, and now 46 people on two floors.
DeMello says he launched the loan repayment service last January with one client, the consulting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers.
And now we're adding about 5 to 6 new clients every single week. We've got about 230 companies.
And demand is only growing as outstanding student loan debt has reached $1.4 trillion. DeMello says it's keeping a lot of younger workers from saving for retirement or buying homes.
The millennial workforce will be 50% of the workforce by 2020, and 75% of them graduate with student loans.
Startups like Tuition.io and Student Loan Genius offer similar services to help employers pay down those loans, and benefits powerhouse Fidelity just entered the business. Some employers are offering the perk without a middleman. Pam Hutchinson is head of human resources for Choptank Transport, a logistics company on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Earlier this year, the company announced it would start matching its employees' student loan payments up to $1,500 a year.
We did it at a company-wide meeting, and there were quite a few cheers and a few sighs of relief.
Choptank has a lot of entry-level jobs and recruits on college campuses. Hutchinson says for people in their 20s, it's a more powerful draw than health insurance or 401ks.
They don't think they're going to get sick. Retirement seems just like eternity away, but this is something that they can take advantage of that'll make a real impact on their life.
About 15 workers have signed up so far, out of just over 300. One of them is Sonny Hopkins, who graduated 8 years ago from Clemson University. He's got a family now and had more than $4,000 to pay off when the benefit started.
Between the help of Choptank and myself, I think the last time I checked, I'm right around $1,000 out. So I'll be wrapping it up here shortly. It's a blessing for sure to have that kind of help.
That kind of gratitude doesn't just help employers hold on to good workers. Kathleen Coulomb is a senior advisor with the Society for Human Resource Management. She says financial stress can affect performance. But despite its appeal, she says only about 4% of employers offer student loan assistance.
I think one of the reasons is the tax implication related to that benefit.
Right now, workers have to pay taxes on any loan assistance they get from an employer. A bill in Congress would change that. Coulomb says much like the tuition reimbursement programs many companies offer, employers would be allowed to contribute up to $5,250 a year for student loans.
And so employers wouldn't pay FICA tax on that benefit, and employees wouldn't pay income tax.
That would make the benefit a lot more attractive to potential recruits, and Gratify's Tim DeMello says likely boost his business
tenfold.
I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Back in February, I did an interview with Sally Krawcheck about her book. It was part memoir, part How to Succeed as a Woman in Corporate America. Fitting, given that for years, Krawcheck was one of the most experienced women in American finance. She left Wall Street after the financial crisis and went on to found a company called Elevest. It's a digital investment platform for women. But when we were talking back in February, she told a story about coming into work one day early in her career and going to her desk. I should say here, by the way, that if young kids are nearby, you ought to cover their ears for about 10 seconds while we play this piece of tape. Here you go.
And I tell you, it's really interesting when there's a Xerox copy of Male Genitalia on your desk. It takes you a minute to realize what it is.
Hmm.
What
yeah.
is this piece of, oh my gosh, look at that.
So that was a while ago that that happened. But it was far from the last time that Krawcheck had to deal with that kind of behavior, including a Me Too episode she wrote about recently. So we got her back on the phone. Sally, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
So that piece of tape, yeah, as I
not
said,
funny actually.
No, it's not actually. But it is oh so relevant to the moment. As I said, you were young and inexperienced when that happened. You didn't know what to do. That was not the last time, though, that you had uncomfortable experiences in your professional career.
Not even close.
And in point of fact, they came as you wrote in your post. When you were older and had a lot of power, or more power anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what a difference is between where I was fortunate enough to be and some of these young women were hearing about Silicon Valley and Hollywood, that they were preyed upon when they were trying to make it in their industry and hadn't had a level of success. Happily, for me, when I had a very senior, very well-known, powerful individual make a pass at me, he wasn't my boss. So this was at the Sanford Bernstein Strategic Decisions Conference. I was the director of research. I went up afterwards to this very well-known, powerful individual, thanked him for joining us, and he turned to me and said, would you like to come up to my hotel room? And then said, blah, 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 blah. That is my tongue sticking out of my mouth and lolling it around. I can't imagine that worked very well for many people. But happily, I was in a position where I could say no to him, and he could not impact my job. Even more happily, several years later, when I was the chief financial officer of Citigroup, our CEO wanted to offer him a job there.
This guy, the same guy.
This same guy.
Yeah.
And I went into my CEO's office and I said, please don't hire him. Here's the story. He said, I'm going to hire him anyway. And I said, okay, your decision. If you do, my decision, I'm going to quit and I'm going to tell everybody why I quit because he'll be a predator here. My boss said, whoa, okay, and didn't hire him. So what this guy doesn't know, he cost himself, but through me, millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars.
You made a point of not naming him, and I wonder why.
I thought about it a lot. I spent the entire weekend that I wrote this piece thinking about should I or shouldn't I. And the reason I decided not to is he is not in a position where he can lord that over other individuals. And as a result of that, I thought, you know what? Not this guy. Not right now.
We're having this moment, I guess, all of us, based on some things that happened in Hollywood. We're having a moment here in public radio, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard. Where is the equivalent moment going to be on Wall Street, which is as sexist and as difficult for women as almost any place else on this planet?
Well, we've been having it. Somehow we seem to have forgotten that, you know, $100+ million was paid out at Smith Barney in the 90s for the Boom Boom Room. Everybody, I keep hearing from everybody, where's Wall Street's Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah.
And I don't know that we're going to see one. And I think the reason is because a Harvey Weinstein could tell young women, I can make you or break you. For Wall Street, it's sort of like, I'll give you the best trades or I'll put you on the best deal. You know, I'm not sure there was the equivalent. Now, I may be completely wrong, and next week we may read about somebody else.
Well, so do you think then we just have to count on, I mean, that's not a fully formed question. What's it going to take then for things to substantively change on Wall Street?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, it's changing because women are saying, I'm sick of this, beep.
Yeah.
And I am going to begin to talk about it. Just a few years ago, Ellen Powell sued Kleiner Perkins for a hostile work environment. And everybody, men and women, just stepped back. And today, people are instead leaning towards this and amplifying these voices and supporting them. So I think the change isn't coming and has never come from the CEOs and the boards are all of a sudden going to decide to really look into this. I think it's coming ground up from women who are just sick of this.
Gets that beep thing again, right? Sally Krawchuk is, after a long career on Wall Street, the co-founder and CEO of Elevest. Sally, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
This final note on the way out today, a follow-up to an interview we did the other day with activist investor Bill Ackman. The proximate cause of the interview, you might remember, was an investment and a proxy fight that Ackman was having with the CEO and the board of directors of ADP, the payroll processing firm. Ackman and his hedge fund, Pershing Square Capital Management, were looking for seats on the board and big changes to the way ADP is run. The shareholder meeting was today. Shareholders said thanks, but no. ADP thus joins other big money bets that Ackman has made that haven't worked out so well, a list that includes Target, Herbalife, as well as Valeant Pharmaceuticals. we got to go. The Dow up 8 points today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ off about 0.8%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.